from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Leo XIV met at the Vatican recently with diplomats accredited to the Holy See and had a very important message for them on life, the human person, and the power of language. This week on Register Radio, we're joined by Frank Rocca, the Vatican editor for EWTN News. And then, why do men leave the priesthood? We talked to Stephen White, executive director of the Catholic Project, to help answer that question. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, host of Register Radio and EWTN News' vice president and editorial director. I'm joined, as always, by Shannon Mullen, co-host of Register Radio and editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register. How are you, Shannon?
I'm well, Matthew. Good to be with you.
How is your new year getting going?
It's quick. I can't believe we're almost through January. So, the pace has been pretty speedy.
What we would have expected, yes. Well, as I was just mentioning, Pope Leo XIV had a traditional meeting with the diplomatic corps accredited to the Holy See. This is traditional for the start of the year. He had one briefly with them in May of last year, soon after his election, and had a couple of things to say there that in many ways anticipated a few of his comments to the diplomatic corps and to the wider world just a couple of days ago. To unpack that and also to give us a bit of a sense of the extraordinary consistory that was also held this last week under Pope Leo and the members of the College of Cardinals, we're joined by Frank Rocca, who is our senior man at the Vatican. Frank is, of course, a very, very long time expert and seasoned journalist. And Frank, it's so great to have you on again.
Thank you, Matthew. It's good to be with you both.
So let's set the atmosphere in a way. Here was Pope Leo's first formal meeting with the diplomats this year. It is, as I was just mentioning, very traditional, but he's had a few encounters with them previously. What was the significance of this particular gathering?
Well, I mean, this is the traditional speech at the beginning of the year. The popes have, I don't know for how long they've been doing this, but certainly Francis and Benedict did it at the beginning of the year, which is generally kind of a survey of the world and also the international relations that the Holy See has conducted over the previous year. And so in that sense, he followed the tradition. But for me, what was really the single most striking aspect of this speech for him was that he gave it in English, because he has been using English increasingly since he became Pope. He was being more careful about it earlier. But this speech was almost entirely in English. He did diplomatically, shall we say, say some words in Italian and thank the Italy and Rome for their cooperation during the Jubilee year and so forth. So he did observe that courtesy, but basically it was in English, which, you know, everyone says, well, makes sense because you have 180 plus countries there. And obviously the lingua franca now is English. It's not French anymore. It certainly was never Italian. But it's a cultural shift. It's a cultural shift and something that people in the Vatican will have to reckon with, and even in the Vatican press corps.
Yeah, Frank, the speech was roundly praised, particularly by the diplomatic corps to the Holy See. As you said, you know, the English really made an impact. And what we heard, you know, as Americans, was some forceful statements about the different war situations around the world, Ukraine, of course, Sudan, Gaza, the tensions in Venezuela, but also about persecutions of Christians around the world. Some really strong comments there, and also about issues of life and human dignity, abortion, euthanasia, but also free speech. So as far as the scope of what he talked about, you've listened to a lot of these speeches. Is this pretty much the norm, or do you think he was at all more pointed or more specific in his address?
His popes have been strong. For example, on the topic of surrogacy, surrogate motherhood, he echoed what Pope Francis said 2 years ago. But Francis arguably was even stronger. I mean, they were both very strong in condemning the practice basically on the basis of exploitation, of economic and social justice, rather than on natural law terms. But they emphasized that. But Francis had actually explicitly said, "I call for a universal ban." Leo didn't actually say that, but I guess he took it for granted that he was for that. But I thought interesting. Yes, he talked about people being persecuted in the West, in Europe, and the United States for promoting the family, promoting life, and also religious freedom. So that was interesting. That was rather specific. Ironically, in a way, when he talked about free speech, he talked about an Orwellian kind of language that supposedly inclusive, but actually, you know, forces people to accept the terms of its ideology or its words to that effect. He didn't get specific there. The bit about language was more opaque. We can guess what he means, and it will be interesting to follow up with him, and we hope we have an opportunity to do that as the press and try to get him to be a bit more specific.
Yeah, talking about that, to quote Pope Leo, he said, "Today the meaning of words is ever more fluid, and the concepts they represent are increasingly ambiguous." And he went on to say, "We need words once again to express distinct and clear realities unequivocally. Only in this way can authentic dialogue resume without misunderstanding." I'm struck by the fact that this echoes in some ways, the bluntness of his speech to the diplomats, echoes what he said to them back in May of last year when he had that meeting with them, where he talked about the fact that sometimes the church needs to speak, and he used the word bluntly, which can lead to misunderstanding. So he seems conscious of the possible reaction to this, but he seems pretty strong and committed to proclaiming what he calls the truth, but proclaimed in charity.
Yes, I think that's right. And again, not to harp on the English again, but I think it was, first of all, that he even used the term Orwellian. That equivalence to that term exists in other languages, including Italian, but it's still something that an Anglophone would be more likely to use. And I think, you know, Orwell, as we know, perhaps we may remember, put a great stress on clarity of language and not being ambiguous and not being evasive. But he linked those, whether explicitly or not, with kind of English language values, short words, not using a lot of Latinate words that could be more easily used to discuss. And I wonder if we're going to see that more and more with Leo, not only when he's speaking English, but in his style. Will he be a little bit more concrete? You know, we've seen that in some of his answers to these press gaggles that have been happening, not every week, but often outside Castel Gandolfo. He gives very short answers, very pithy answers. And while Francis could be very provocative in his way, he wasn't always so concrete.
Frank, the speech to the diplomats was sort of the capstone of a big week for Pope Leo. Many observers saw the conclusion of the Jubilee of Hope, that was on the 6th, and the extraordinary consistory with the College of Cardinals, which is the following day and a half, as really kind of the start of Leo's pontificate. The idea being these previous months, he was dealing with a lot of unfinished business of Pope Francis's pontificate. That's kind of largely wrapped up, and that we would get a better, clearer picture of Leo's own priorities. Do you think that happened? Do you see his agenda any clearer after last week?
Well, I do think he's unveiling himself, shall we say, his values and his agenda gradually. I think one thing you didn't mention that also fits into that is he began a new series of talks at catechesis at his weekly public audience, and the first weekly public audience of the new year. He said, "I'm going to start going through the documents of Vatican II." Now, that's very interesting because we remember that, for example, Benedict, in his first year as Pope, laid out a kind of agenda for promoting what he called the hermeneutic of reform and continuity of the tradition. In other words, a reading of Vatican II that stresses continuity, not rupture, right? And then we know that, for example, in with liturgy, he brought back the Latin Mass for those who wanted it and that sort of thing. Now, so we wonder, is Leo sort of going to give us a key to his values by walking us through Vatican II? Now, one clue that was interesting was he stressed two things in that talk. He said he quoted every pope from John the 23rd up to through Francis, even John Paul I, who was very briefly Pope, which stresses, and I would certainly send a signal of continuity, right? That he believes that these popes, very different in some ways, you know, are all to be listened to when it comes to interpreting the council. And the other thing he did, quoted all those popes. Oh, and he stressed the documents. Now, we may commit too much of that, but as we know, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the spirit of Vatican II and kind of more expansive, elastic readings and understandings of what Vatican II meant is in it. And other people, more conservative readers, tend to stress the letter of the documents. He kept talking about the documents. So that might mean that he'll be more, give him a narrow reading, perhaps. It's not clear. I should also add that, you know, Benedict and John Paul talked a lot about Vatican II. They were both at Vatican II, of course. They were both a part of it. Francis, in the words of his one of his advisors, Father Antonio Spadaro, took Vatican II for granted. He didn't really quote it all that often. He certainly didn't go through systematically and read the documents. And so this is interesting. It's perhaps we're moving back to a more rigorous and perhaps a more restrained reading of the council. We'll see.
Yeah, and talking about one could argue a certain restoration of things. His convoking of the extraordinary consistory, his pledge also to have another one in June and then to have these at least once a year from what he's describing, is that something itself of a mark of continuity with his predecessors, given the fact that Pope Francis at times seemed reluctant to bring all of the cardinals together?
Right. In that sense, it was a very traditional move that harkens back to the papacy before Francis, because Francis really only called the cardinals together once for a true extraordinary consistory in which they were free to bring up any topic they wanted. And now Leo has already met with him twice, once shortly after his election, and now again. And now he says, as you say, he's going to do it every year. And in fact, twice this year, because he's going to do it in June. So that's giving the listening to the so-called Pope Senate, as the College of Cardinals is traditionally known. And the cardinals, you know, once had a lot more power even than they do now. They typically, the cardinal prefects really ran the curia in Rome. And so going back to them, that's very traditional. On the other hand, and this is very much with Leo, he used the format. Use the format that Francis introduced for the synod, which is people sitting around tables, round tables, and, you know, discussing and arriving at some kind of consensus. So he does invoke synodality, which is a favorite word of Francis. So again, we don't know yet. Is he just trying to sort of appease everyone and sort of balance everything out? Or to what extent is he going to retain Francis's idea of the synod as a more inclusive, shall we say, group, which include members of the laity sitting side by side with bishops and cardinals? On the other hand, Francis's synodality, the way it worked in practice, was much more controlled. The themes were controlled. Everything was confidential. People were directed as to how they were supposed to dialogue. This might be a more open approach for the cardinals. So it's still evolving. We'll see what the Leo's concept of synodality really means.
And we'll appreciate even more his style of governance and where he wants to take the church. Well, Frank, as always, a pleasure to have you, and thank you again for everything you do.
Well, thank you both. Thank you, Matthew, Shannon.
When we come back, we explore the question of why men leave the priesthood. We talk with an academic who's trying to find out exactly why. This is Register Radio. Please stay tuned and don't go anywhere.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, here as always with Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Well, the question is often asked, why do men leave the priesthood? And researchers have set out to figure out exactly how many priests are leaving ministry and what can be done to prevent it, especially younger priests. It's an important phenomenon. It's an important reality for the church. Stephen White, executive director of the Catholic Project, a noted education and research body that focuses on Catholic clergy and lay people to address the pressing issues in the church, such as why do men leave the priesthood, joins us now. And I'm delighted to welcome you back, Stephen, to Register Radio. I know you've been on before.
It's good to be with you both.
Well, let's start with the question of the Catholic Project, because I think this is you're an important body, and I'm not sure how many people are aware of what you do and why you exist.
Yeah, well, we began in early 2019, so almost 7 years ago, basically in response to the abuse crisis that was sort of rocking the church in 2018 and early 2019. A lot of our work initially focused directly on the question of abuse. We produced an award-winning podcast and did some academic conferences. We had a program designed to help people who are in a position to build out safeguarding measures for young people. So we had a lot of different things going on from very early on. In the more recent years, we've come to look more specifically at challenges facing priests and bishops and seminarians. In 2022, we conducted the largest survey of American Catholic priests in more than 50 years, the National Study of Catholic Priests. We published a report that year, a subsequent report in 2023, and we did a follow-up report this past year in 2025, looking at challenges that priests are facing. How are they doing? How is their relationship with bishops? What are their pastoral priorities? So our work has really come to focus on the challenges facing clergy in particular these days. But from a sort of a research perspective, and hopefully our work is helping some people do good things for our priests.
Yeah, Stephen, there's a lot of data about what's going on in dioceses, you know, the number of parishioners, the number of baptisms, marriages, funerals, and things like that. But there's just some glaring blind spots, right? And one of them is going to be addressed in this initiative that we'll talk about in a moment. But just in general, what are some of the blind spots that strike you that we really don't have actionable hard data on in our church?
Yeah, well, anecdotally, there's a rise in the number of men voluntarily leaving the priesthood. These aren't the cases that generally show up in headlines. There's nothing criminal involved. But for one reason or another, a man after ordination decides that he can't continue in ministry, and so he'll appeal for laicization or sometimes he'll just go on a sabbatical for an extended period. One of the things that makes this difficult is obviously each diocese knows how many men are in the various states of leaving the ministry, but that's not data that's readily available, and it's not the kind of thing that dioceses are super eager usually to share publicly, both out of respect for the men in question, right? These are delicate matters having to do with often confidential things, and there's a vocation at stake that the diocese doesn't want to sort of air that dirty laundry in a way that might be damaging to people now or in the future. At the same time, I've heard so much, so often from priests, from bishops, from people who work in seminaries, that this is a growing problem. It would be really important to get, first and foremost, just a number. Are the numbers actually up? If so, what are the numbers? Are they way up? Are they up a little bit? This doesn't seem to be analogous to the decades immediately following the council, when you had, you know, men leaving the priesthood in droves. So get a sense of what the scale of the problem is, and then start looking at what might be done to address it, to resolve it. I mentioned, you know, obviously there's a person at stake, the person's vocation is at stake. You know, we want to preserve those priestly vocations if we can. But on a very practical level, dioceses commit tremendous resources and time and money to train these men, and that investment should be protected to the degree it can be. So there's a lot of reasons to want to get a clearer sense of what's going on, precisely so it can be addressed, both for the sake of the diocese and our priests, but also for the sake of the men in question.
Well, as you say, Stephen, the research is still anecdotal. We need a lot more of it. But what are the indications as to the causes for this? I noticed in our reporting, and you provided such valuable content and context for this, issues of loneliness, of a sense of isolation seem to come up quite a bit. But what else is at work here?
Yeah, there are a number of hypotheses. One is isolation. One is, you know, both in the sense of just being in a rectory by yourself. You go from living a communal, almost monastic life in seminary, where you've got lots of other men around you, to being out alone. Part of it is the learning curve of becoming a pastor. It used to be the case that men had 5, 10, maybe 15 years essentially to apprentice before being put in charge of a parish. Now you have guys who are being asked to run a parish or two or three with just a couple years out from ordination. I know a young priest who upon ordination was made pastor of 6 parishes. That's not so much a learning curve. That's a brick wall. And so you have increased concerns about burnout among younger priests. There are usual causes. Some men go into it with all good faith and realize that living a life of celibacy is a challenge that they were unprepared for. So there are a lot of reasons you could suppose. I think one thing that I'm interested in looking at is how the kinds of preparation that seminaries aren't really designed to do might affect this. And what I mean by that is among younger men, suppose you have a young man who's very devout. He loves our Lord. He's in love with the idea of the priesthood of offering the sacraments, and he gets into a parish and he realizes that most of what he does on a daily basis has to do with running a business, essentially, right? Managing the buildings and the facilities and dealing with sort of putting out all the little fires that happen in a parish life. That could be an abrupt wake-up call, right? Where you have one idea of what you're getting into, you get ordained, and then you hit the ground running and you realize this isn't at all what I signed up for. So some of the human preparation, getting a sense for what adult life means, not just for priests, but for everybody, that kind of stuff is usually learned in family, in our communities, from our friends. And I think a lot of seminaries are realizing they need to do more to prepare men for those sort of human realities. But again, it's not really something seminaries were built to do. So they're playing catch up in a way. But I think there's also a sense in which one of the things that we all can do to help our priests is to sort of be better at the laity, at doing the kind of formation for our young people that needs to be done, that has to happen in our families, in our homes, in our communities. Because some of those young men are going to end up with a priestly vocation, and they'll be better prepared for it if they have that human formation done long before they ever set foot in a seminary.
Yeah, Stephen, the Register's reporting on this topic, you know, first identified that this was a concern. Why are so many young priests leaving the priesthood? But that there was, as you said, a lack of hard data. Now that's changing. Talk to us about this, about $500,000 grant that the Knights of Columbus are providing. What's going to happen with this initiative?
Yeah, there are several different components to this grant, but one of them is to specifically look at the question of priestly attrition or priest resignations. As I said, the basic outline is to try and convince, working with bishops to get dioceses to share their data with us, and to do that in a responsible and discreet way. You know, guarantee anonymity. We don't want to show anybody up, but we want to be able to provide hard data so that bishops and seminary formators can make better decisions going forward. And the second thing is to conduct a series of qualitative interviews with seminary formators, with priests themselves, with bishops, with the people who are around these young men in formation, and even hopefully talk to a good number of men who have actually left. The idea is it would be very difficult to just do a survey of men who have left the priesthood, and there are reasons to think that they might not... that the answers we would get from such a survey would be a bit unusable, in the sense some of these men might bear a grudge, some of them might be unhappy, some might be perfectly fine with how things have worked out, but that would be hard to sort out. So the idea is to do a qualitative study, to talk to the people who are around it and sort of help them use their words to sort of sketch in the picture about what's going on from the people who are closest to the cases involved.
Yeah, Stephen, the dimensions of this, so we're obviously focusing on the United States, but do you anticipate that this is also a global reality? And sort of connected to that, what levels of cooperation are you seeing or anticipate from the hierarchy, given the significance of these possible departures?
To the first part, I don't know how this problem translates to other countries and other parts of the church. That's sort of a question beyond my ken. I anticipate good participation and cooperation from the hierarchy. I think for this reason, you know, the work that we've done at the Catholic Project, I think, has proven our bona fides. We're, like I said, we're not here to stir the pot. We're here to try and provide the kind of data that is helpful to men in ministry and to the formators of men who are going into ministry. And I think the case can be made to our bishops that that our ability to do this is going to be a boon to them, but it's dependent on their cooperation. So we've made good contacts, and I think have very good working relationships with a lot of bishops and with the bishops' conference from our studies over the last several years. And I'm hoping that will translate to good collaboration going forward.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, I hope that you can come back and update us on all of this, given the obvious importance of it to the life of the church and to the very men that you're serving who are serving the priesthood.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And I really appreciate the Register doing such great coverage. Joan has been really good in his coverage of this story so far. So I look forward to hearing more from him, too.
Yeah. And where can people find more about the Catholic Project?
Easiest way is on our website, catholicproject.catholic.edu. The Google machine works, will show up. But yeah, appreciate it.
Excellent. Well, Stephen White, thanks so much.
Take care.
Well, that's it for Register Radio for this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks again for joining us. Until next week, on behalf of our producer, Michael McCall, and always Shannon Mullen, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Please take care and God bless.